Finding Smith Madrone Winery on top of Spring Mountain can be a bit of a challenge. But remember, when in doubt, turn right. Those are the best directions. A modest building houses the aging barrels, a table set for tasting, a display of awards and ribbons, and that is Smith Madrone. Stuart and Charlie Smith have been making wine on Spring Mountain for over 35 years, and they've seen some amazing changes in Napa Valley. Charlie Smith and I sat out behind the winery sipping coffee, looking out at the vines, and enjoying an incredibly beautiful spring day. Charlie, tell me how you and Stuart ended up in the wine business.
Well, we grew up in Santa Monica on the coast. We were sort of beach kids, really. Stuart, in fact, was a lifeguard during the summers in the Santa Monica. Very good. Incidentally, just by the by, being a lifeguard in Santa Monica is a very good summer job when you're in college. It pays a lot, you know? I don't really know how we got interested in wine. I remember when I was an undergraduate at Berkeley, I had a roommate who was from St. Helena, and I'm pretty sure he is the first person I ever heard utter the words Cabernet Sauvignon, which I had never heard of. We grew up in a martini and, you know, two martini before dinner family. But one way and another, somehow at Berkeley, and he's a couple of years behind me, and we overlapped there, and somehow we got interested in wine. And Berkeley's a good place to get interested in wine. Because even back in the 60s, there were 3, 4, 5 really quality little wine shops there. So if you got obsessive about wine and you were sort of doing your reading and finding out about things, you could read about all these fancy, you know, exotic, what seemed exotic then, and wonderful, Bordeaux and Burgundies and so forth. And then you could go to you could hunt them out in the stores. You could find them. If you had the money, you could buy them, which mostly we didn't have the money, I mean. So that was, you know, one thing sort of led to another. Essentially, wine became a hobby that got completely out of control. Right. So it's largely Stuart's deal. He graduated and I was already out, and he'd graduated in economics and went off to UC Davis in Enology and Viticulture. So that was probably about 66. And then he was there like 67, 68, something like that. And he managed to get some money together and come up here and buy 200 acres. And I was teaching school at the time, and I thought, oh, and I had an opportunity to come up here and join him as well. And I thought, well, if I don't do this now, you know, it may not happen. It seemed like a really wild thing to do. So, you know, basically it's Stuart's fault. That's why 35 years later, 36 years later, I'm sitting here talking to you because my brother went ballistic over wine back in the late 60s.
You guys came to Spring Mountain at an amazing time in Napa's history.
Yeah, this was a different valley. It was a different industry. It was a different time, really. Napa was, in those days, I would say, a small agricultural backwater, really. It wasn't the Napa that we think of today, sort of world famous. Among interested wine people, it had a reputation as a place that produced good wine. That reputation rested on the reputation of people like BV. Andrei Chelichev was making wine at BV. The George de la Tour Private Reserve was very famous. Inglenook had been, even though it had been bought out by a couple of large concerns. I think Hublin may have owned it back then, or maybe it was something even before, maybe it was even before Hublin. But, you know, Inglenook had made really terrific wine. Martini and Krug were here, and there were a few small wineries here and there. Stony Hill, Souverain, and a few other people. I think there were less, in fact, I'm certain that there were less wineries in Napa County than there are currently in the Spring Mountain District. When I try and count up how many wineries there were in the county, I can only get as high as 22 or 23. And that's the whole county, mind you, not just the valley itself, just the whole county. Right. So it was a very small place. Cattle, in fact, was the biggest cash crop in the county then. It wasn't grapes at all. We were very lucky to have come here when we did. I think if we'd waited 10 or 15 years, it probably wouldn't have been possible. So we were lucky with the timing. It was at a time when it was affordable to come here and buy 200 acres, which is what happened. And of course, it was all forest. A lot of these old places that were in the hills had been abandoned at the onset of Prohibition. When Prohibition finally came into effect in January of 1920, vineyards and wineries that were in the hills were essentially non-starters. I mean, their business was wiped out. This is not good ground for growing anything other than grapes, really, and a few olive trees, as you see here. All these places in the hills were just abandoned and they just walked away. Down in the valley, they converted to other forms of agriculture, prune plums and walnuts and things like that. So the forest grew back completely. And the view that we, as we sit and see here, didn't exist then. It was completely, you know, we had 50-year-old trees. We're looking across at Howell Mountain. Right. That's Howell Mountain directly across from us.
So your first job was to eliminate a whole lot of trees.
A 50-year-old Douglas fir is a pretty tall item. We actually, out of the first 20 acres here, there was 250,000 board feet of Douglas fir that was logged out of here. Had an arrangement with an old cat skinner, had a great big tractor. Wonderful old guy named Tucker, and we paid him for tractor time, and he paid us for the logs, and it was kind of a push. You just push the trees over, you know. You don't cut them down by hand. Even though you've got tractors and things, it's really a lot of work. There's no doubt about it. I can't imagine what it was like in the 19th century before you had mechanized equipment. I think those guys really knew how to work back then, because it's an impressive amount of work even today. So anyhow, by the end of the first year, there were 20 acres open, and we planted 5 acres each of Cabernet, Chardonnay, and Riesling, the three varieties we still make, and then we had 5 acres of Pinot Noir as well, which we made for 10 years or so until we grafted it over to Chardonnay in the late 80s. We weren't happy with it, really. We made one very spectacular wine in 1980, which is beginning to be quite a long time ago. The wine's still, there's still a few bottles of it down in the cellar. And at 26 years, I won't kid you that it's still young anymore. It's not, but it's surprisingly good. It was a splendid wine. I thought it was just between us. I thought it was just about the best Pinot Noir I'd ever tasted out of California. The trouble is, the wines in front of it and behind it were just mediocre as all get out. We just couldn't do it again. It was just a perfect confluence of events. We ended up, there was another wine over the years has developed beautifully in the bottle. So I would say out of about 10 or 12 years of winemaking, we managed to make two that really made us happy. And that's just not enough. So Chardonnay was beginning to be hugely popular and we needed more Chardonnay. So we were tired of filling with Pinot Noir. Four wines for us was a lot of, just a little bit too many wines to make anyway. So besides that, we're the ones that are showing people around here and giving them the taste of wine. And you really hate like hell to have to apologize for the wine that you're pouring for somebody. So it was getting rid of it was a good thing. We've been making the three wines ever since, you know.
How do you feel about the rating system featured in the major wine magazines?
I think there's a lot. There's probably a little bit too much fuss made about scores. I'm not at all keen on this insistence on, I'm an opponent of the 100-point scale. Most of the people I know seem to have a pretty good attitude about it, honestly. Most people don't drink $100 or $200 wines every night. I mean, we don't, and even the people I know who can actually afford that, for the most part, don't do that.
Charlie, a little off the subject, but what are your thoughts on screw caps?
Okay. That's right. That's a good question. And I've pretty much got a real opinion about it. All the indications are is that screw caps are superior. It dovetails with a regular sort of gripe I have, which is that there's a lot of misconceptions in the wine business just generally. If you pick up a wine book, somewhere along the line, you're going to see something about wines being left, you know, being on their side with corks, you know, and about how this slow transfer of gases through the corks is supposed to be good for the wine and good for the aging process and so on and so forth. That appears to be completely bogus. There doesn't appear to be any merit behind that argument at all. Wines don't age well because of the cork. They age well in spite of the cork. I've thought that for a long time, and it seems to me one of the proofs of that is port. Ports have traditionally been sealed with wax and aged beautifully and for long periods of time without access to oxygen. Oxygen is and always has been the enemy of wine, I think. And nothing is better at keeping oxygen away from wine over an extended period of time than a screw cap. I have not tasted this stuff directly, but I have heard reliable reports coming out of Australia of 25-year-old Rieslings that have been bottled with screw caps on them that have just aged spectacularly well. I have no doubt that it's true. Now, this does not mean I'm in favor of screw caps. I'm not. I like the romance of wine. Okay? I mean, there's no question that there's sort of magic surrounding wine and that screw caps don't have any magic at all. And my normal response to this question is, when Chateau Lafite Rothschild goes to her screw caps, so will Smith Madron. But until that time, forget about it. I'm not going to be bottling stuff that we're proud of in screw caps, right?
Where does the name Smith Madron go after you and Stuart?
Stuart has 5 kids. I don't know whether they're going to be interested in the wine business or not. My own son is older, and he's already working on his second career, and he's not. He's a wine lover and a wine consumer, but he was brought up in the wine business, and he, you know, you got to have, it's sort of a, it's, I think I worked him in the vineyard a little too much, you know. He's you know, when he was little, he used to come out and help me do stuff like string irrigation, very, very unglamorous stuff. And then you've really got to have a taste for it, I think. So we don't really know what we're going to be, perfectly candid. You know, we're probably poster children for poor planning here. We're just going to keep working at it as long as we can, and we don't have any particular interest in retiring right at the moment. And, you know, when we both get too old to actually, you know, run crush by ourselves, then we'll start talking about what the heck to do. You know, you only get to make 1 wine a year, right? It's not very much. I've been making wine most of my adult life, you know, I mean, for nearly 35 years. That's only 35 Cabernets. I don't think that's a lot. I'm up for more.
I became a big fan of your wine with the 2001 vintage.
Oh, yeah. I just opened a bottle of the 01 the other day. I haven't impressed myself. It's just a lovely Bordeaux-style wine. I've always thought of us as being a hillside winery, making California hillside, Napa Valley hillside Cabernet. But when the wines have been in the bottle for a couple of years, it may have something to do with the fact for the last few years we've been blending in some Cabernet Franc and some Merlot, especially Merlot, but a little bit of Cabernet Franc. But the wines are turning out to be so elegant and Bordeaux-like when they've been in the bottle. It surprises me a little bit, you know? I think of them as being sort of, when they're bottled, as being typical of hillsides, but somehow they just keep turning into Bordeaux's. I was sort of blind to this for a while. I kept hearing reports about tastings that would take place in various places that we were involved in, you know, and people were, you know, when they were blind, they would think of us as the Bordeaux and so forth, and it turned out it was us. It sort of surprised me, but I'm finally getting it, you know. In the old days, it was 100% Cabernet, 70s and 80s. You know, most of the wines in the valley were 100% Cabernet back then, and they're not any longer, right? I'm sure that 100%, I don't know what the percentage of wineries that produce 100% versus a blended Cabernet, but I'd be pretty sure that the majority of the wines now have at least some Merlot or Cabernet Franc or whatever in it, you know.
Charlie, what makes you crazy about the wine business?
It's the incessant promotion that's required. And there's a lot of schmoozing, and there's just no getting around it. And it gets to be sort of a burden after a while. I tend to do most of the stuff here at the winery. That is to say, I take care of most of the visitors that come to the winery. And then when distributors have to be massaged, then Stuart goes out and does that. So we think of ourselves as Mr. Inside and Mr. Outside, right? So I'm Mr. Inside and he's Mr. Outside. And there is a lot of it, you know. And I think that's... I'm not sure when you get into the wine business initially, you're quite prepared for how much it is. It's more now than it used to be. There's so much more competition, for starters. You know, I guess I'm getting in an age where I keep looking backward, but good God, you know, back in the 70s when we started up, we actually had people from restaurants in LA phoning us. You know, that's simply impossible now. There's just too much of it. So Stuart's got an analogy, my brother, that I'm very fond of. He's the one who I first heard this from, and I like this a lot. And it's this. that being in the wine business is a lot like being a swan in a lake. The swan's sailing along beautifully, but underneath, those little feet are just working like mad, right? That's pretty much the wine business in a nutshell. It seems important to everyone to always be putting a good face on the thing. You know, we never have bad vintages. Everything's glamorous and glorious and beautiful, and the wine's wonderful all the time. And in the meantime, underneath, those little feet are working really hard to make that happen.
So do you ever get the chance to taste your neighbor's wine?
Yeah, I taste stuff. I look forward to tasting it, in fact. There's a number of get-togethers here on Spring Mountain that occur on a sort of annual basis. And one of the things about it is getting to taste everybody's wine. Absolutely. I'm sure. In fact, it's one of the pieces of magic that's never gone away from me is that I think tasting wine is hugely fun for me. That's never ceased to be, you know, a really enjoyable part of the process. It's, in a sense, having a winery and a vineyard sort of like a giant toy, because there are, in spite of the fact that it's a lot of work, there are still really fun things about it, and tasting wine still is extremely interesting to me.
Up here on Spring Mountain, you have a very, very simple tasting room, and it's on an incredibly beautiful piece of land.
It's a little bit like this. It's not quite enough to justify us hiring somebody to show them around. And if we did that, some of the magic of coming up here would be a little bit lost anyway. I think it's an interesting experience for people to actually talk to the guys who are actually making the wine and doing the work. But at the same time, while we can't justify hiring somebody to do it, it takes a lot of our time. And so just about the time I get cranky, you know, and somebody else barges in the door saying, hey, can we have a tour, which happens a lot, I try not to growl. And then it turns out that they're really nice. And they have an interesting story to tell, you know. And, you know, we start talking, and they just turn out to be terrific folks. And the reason they came up here was to come here. So it's not like when people visit here, it's not at all like you've got a tasting bar down along Highway 29. We get very few casual drop-ins here. So I do feel some obligation for, you know, to be nice to people who have gone to the trouble without instructions and managed somehow to find us, even though maybe misguidedly they didn't think they needed an appointment, which they actually do by the rules of our permit to operate. We still don't throw anybody out if they don't have an appointment.
The last time I visited you, I was able to watch you punch down the cap. That was fun.
Some of the Cabernet is made in very small half-ton bins. It's largely sort of overage for us, but let's say when the larger containers, when there's an odd lot. But I really enjoy it. I believe in punching down. It's an important part of the mix. When you punch down stuff, it really does have a slightly different quality than you pump it over. And there's a real pleasure in the colors and the sort of Rice Krispie sound that you hear of the stuff, you know, bubbling along, and people get a kick out of it, and I get a kick out of doing it, actually. It's one of those chores that's more pleasure than anything else, really. Punching down during harvest is. So, are you running out of questions?
Not really, but, you know, I could sit up here all day and talk about wine with you. So, Charlie, thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
Not at all. Happy to do it.